Evidence and Answers begins right now.
Studies show that more than 60% of Christians ages 18 to 25 question whether the Bible is historically reliable. That's why biblical archaeology has never been more important, because thousands of discoveries confirm the Bible's accuracy. Dr. Stephen Collins reveals the compelling evidence from history and archaeology that will equip you to defend your faith with confidence. You're tuned to Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. Today, we will conclude Message 6 in Evidence and Answers 2025 conference series. Here is Dr. Stephen Collins with Why Biblical Archaeology Matters.
Realize that in antiquity, there was no public literacy. The average person on the street could not read and write. Language writing systems like hieroglyphics, like cuneiform, even pictographic writing, were so complex that only highly skilled, highly trained scribes and educated elites could read it. And you were not going to get that kind of an education as a commoner. You just weren't. Wasn't going to happen. So the only people who could read and write in antiquity are in the top echelons of society. Everybody else is illiterate. But it's interesting that God required literacy of his people. Now let's talk about that alphabet that we mentioned earlier. In the 19th century, as we said, the alphabet was seen as being invented somewhere around the time of King David, King Solomon, 10th, 9th century. But by the first decade or two of the 20th century, discoveries by people like Sir Flinders Petrie and others in the Sinai and in other locations found alphabetic writing. And we then knew quickly that the alphabet didn't date from the 10th century BC. It dated at least from the 15th century BC, which is time of who? Moses. Well, and then it got even better if you're a Bible believer, worse if you're one of those higher critics. And then by about the 1960s, 70s, new discoveries showed down in Egypt that the alphabet was invented by slave populations in Egypt, and they were starting to use it by the 1700s BC. Recent discovery just a few months ago shows us that it's possible that the Semitic alphabetic writing, this is all the same alphabet, the Semitic writing may now go back, in the alphabetic writing, back to before 2000 BC. So now we know that by the time Moses came along, the alphabet was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years old. It was already existing. But what is more than a coincidence is that there's only been one alphabet in the history of the world. Every other alphabet in the world derives from that original alphabet. So, well, the letters look really different in the Hebrew alphabet and the English alphabet. Yeah, but they all derive. You can track them all. Every alphabet tracks back to that old archaic Semitic alphabet. Why was the alphabet only invented once in the history of the world? Israelite literacy. God demanded Israelite literacy. And if you're going to demand literacy, you better have an alphabet that's easy to learn. I mean, an adult with average intelligence can learn how to read and write in a weekend with an alphabet. Learn the alphabet, learn the sounds, sound the letters out. You can do it. And by the way, the Israelites had an alphabet now. We know that. They had the alphabet. And they had to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. What in the world do you have to do in the wilderness for 40 years other than learn the alphabet? I mean, they had a lot of downtime. A few battles here and there, but there's a lot of downtime. Now, how do we know that God demanded public literacy? Because God told Joshua, when you go into the land, I want you to send some guys across that river. I want you to set up on the promised land side of the Jordan River, I want you to set up three large standing stones. And I want you to cover them over with plaster, and I want you to write on them the words of the law. Not the whole law, the print would be too small. right? But probably the Ten Commandments, I want you to write on them the words of the law so that as my people come into the land, they must read the words of the law. Literacy. Why didn't the ancient rulers want common people to be literate? Because reading is information and information is power. But God wanted his people to hold their leaders accountable to the law of God given by Moses. And they did it from time to time, not always perfectly, but God wanted the Israelites to be able to, somebody like Nathan the prophet, to go to King David and shake his finger under the king's nose. By the way, if that had happened in Egypt to a Pharaoh, what do you think would happen to that prophet? But David was shaken to his sandals because Nathan was right, because David knew the law. Remember, he had written, "Thy word is a lamp unto my feet." And Nathan shook his finger under King David's nose and said, "You're the man I'm talking about. You're the man that has done this sin." That's all due to the literacy demanded by God. He wanted his people to be able to read their laws so that they could hold their leaders accountable. It's exactly the way it happened. Well, Israelite literacy, to me, that's just amazing. This is in the Bronze Age. This is going way back. Did Moses have an alphabet? Absolutely. Absolutely. No problem there. It was existing half a millennium before Abraham was ever born. This is another one. Canaanite religious practices. The Old Testament is full of prohibitions against the religious practices of the Canaanites. Ritual prostitution, male and female ritual prostitution, sacrificing of children. A man should not lie with a man, it says. A man should not lie with a beast. That was going on too. In religious context, in the temples of Baal and the other gods of the Canaanites and the Amorites. So God says, no, you shall not do this. Man shall not lie with a man, and man shall not lie with a beast, and you will not cause your children to pass through the fire. That is to sacrifice your children to the Phoenician god Molech. And so all through the law and through the Old Testament, details about the Canaanite practices, the debauchery, and the pagan religion were very detailed, and we can read them. But what's interesting is if you get to the late Iron Age in the time of Israel and Judah, especially Judah after the Assyrians had taken out the northern kingdom, there's not a lot of that going on. The Canaanites are almost extinct. And all of these things, the Asherah worship, the Ashtaroths, the Baals, and all these gods, they're almost wiped out because the Israelites are finally, by that time, especially during and after the Babylonian captivity, are finally starting to get it. We shouldn't go chasing after the foreign gods. We need to be faithful to the one true God, Yahweh. So they were finally starting to get it. But the Mosaic Law is full of all of these detailed prohibitions against all kind of terrible practices that were existing in the Bronze Age. And that we find in the archaeology constantly, even at Tal Hamam, at Sodom, we find evidences of this kind of worship, of pagan worship. And so it's exactly as it should be. Joshua, in fact, we were talking yesterday to some folks, and they had learned in college that that Kathleen Kenyon had excavated Jericho, and there was no fortified city at Jericho for Joshua to conquer during the late Bronze Age. And that was done in the 50s. She did that in the 50s, and from that time forward, most scholars since then have said, well, Kathleen Kenyon proved there wasn't any city at Jericho during the time of Joshua, so he couldn't have destroyed it. It's a myth. It's a myth. But we've worked very closely with the Jericho team over the years, and over the last 20-25 years, they have now confirmed, they're starting to publish, but they have now confirmed, guess what? There is a fortified city at Jericho during the second half of the late Bronze Age, the time of Moses and Joshua. It actually is there. So don't believe what you read, because if you read anything other than that, then you're reading what you're seeing is not up to date. It's antique. In fact, in archaeology, it's very hard to go back and be sure about reading anything that was written more than 20 years ago, even 15 years ago. Because archaeology, from discovery, from the time we dig it out of the ground until it gets published and publicized, that's usually a 30 to 40 year lag. So a lot of the stuff that you would read now, a lot of the stuff that, you know, these secular professors try to throw at our Christian kids, they say, oh, this didn't happen, and that didn't happen, and this didn't happen. That's what he thinks, but he's behind the times. You know, he's way, way behind. The archaeology has been advancing, and the Bible is getting demonstrated to be historically accurate over and over again. Yes, there was a Jericho during the time of Joshua. So the Battle of Jericho is absolutely correct. The Merneptah Stela. In 1210 BC, Merneptah, the son of Ramesses the Great, put up a stela, and on it he claimed that Israel was one of the nine perennial enemies of Egypt. Now, what's the significance of that? Now, think about this. This is 1210. If Ramesses was the Pharaoh of the Exodus, then how does Israel become one of the nine perennial enemies of Egypt on the Merneptah Stela by 1210? I mean, that would only, maybe Joshua hadn't even arrived yet. I mean, you'd have to back the Exodus up into the reign of Ramesses, allow 40 years wandering in the wilderness, and enough time for the conquest for Israelite to be in the land. Well, this doesn't give you enough time. This confirms that the Israelite exodus and conquest has to have happened probably in at least the previous century, not in the 13th century. I like this one, smite, smote, smitten. This is so subtle, but did you know that there was a type of sword in the Bronze Age? There was no thrusting, pointed, double-edged thrusting sword in the Bronze Age. That was invented in the Iron Age, okay? So Joshua's sword looks like this. That sharp outer curved edge, this is like a kind of a two-fisted hacking weapon. And this is the sword for armies in the time of Moses and Joshua, and they even had a version of it prior to that going back to the time of Abraham. But going forward into the Iron Age, and what just happened from the Bronze Age to the Iron Age? Iron. And if you put an iron sword up against a bronze sword, guess who wins? That bronze sword is just going to break. The iron sword is going to win every time. And so, but the iron swords now, the new iron swords were straight, pointed, and a thrusting sword. And so this one went out of business. But what's interesting, in the Torah, in fact, the first seven books of the Bible through the book of Judges, smite with the edge, singular, to smite with the edge of the sword, which reflects this weapon, is used about 28 times in those narratives. But by the end of the Iron Age, of the Bronze Age, going into the Iron Age, this sickle sword starts to die out, and within a couple hundred years, it's extinct. And if you follow the Bible text, you'll see that you'll get smitten with the edge of the sword until you get to the end of the book of Judges, and then you're into the Iron Age, and that idiom soon disappears. It just trails off and disappears in the rest of the Bible. Now, how subtle is that? It's the linguistics now tied to a material weapon that coincide precisely with the history of that weapon. Try doing that from a distance, writing a fiction in the Iron Age. You can't do it. It's all wrong. This is eyewitness stuff. These are eyewitness accounts of the events they describe. The people were there, and they knew every rivet in their helmet and every tack in their shoes. They knew it all. Let's stop with this one. God has a great sense of humor. You're going to see it with this. In the Iliad, there is a story where you have a priestess princess stolen from her father by the Mycenaean Greeks. And they take her off, and because the god of the island is now ticked off, he brings suffering and plagues to the people who stole her. And so they had a protocol for returning an object stolen from a foreign god to appease that god so he stopped afflicting us. But you got to have the right ritual. You got to have the right protocol. So what do? They look at the protocol. Yeah, okay, they go to the priest. Okay, this is the protocol. This is how we return this stolen property. Now, she lived on an island, so they got a boat. They put a team of oxen on the boat. They put her on the boat. They put on the boat little golden statues of mice and of tumors, okay? And then the priests and the officials get on the boat, and they sail to the island, and they take the oxen off, have a big sacrifice to the god, and they give it. And so they're following the protocol. We're giving it back. We're appeasing the foreign god, and now we can cease to be afflicted. What's interesting is, do you remember when the Philistines stole the Ark of the Covenant from the Israelites? Remember, they got the Ark of the Covenant, and they took it to Philistine territory. Now, I want to ask you, remember, in Homer, it's the Mycenaean Greeks who have this ritual protocol for returning an object stolen from a foreign god who is now afflicting us because we've done this. Who are the Philistines? Who are the biblical Philistines? We know from archaeology very clearly. They're the Mycenaean Greeks. They're the Mycenaean Greeks who came to the eastern end of the Mediterranean, set up in those cities. They have very distinctive pottery from the Aegean area. We know who the Philistines are. They are the Mycenaean Greeks. And so when the Philistines stole the Ark of the Covenant, they started it on a circuit, and the circuit was going from city to city, but every place it went, God was afflicting the Philistines. And I love the old King James rendering of this. It says, God afflicted them with, now some of the later translations just say tumors. The King James says hemorrhoids. Now if that's true, then God really has a sense of humor, because every place the Ark of the Covenant went, the Philistines had a hard time sitting down. And they were very uncomfortable. And so that's why the Ark kept moving. God afflicts them, and they move it to another city. Get rid of this thing. And they move it to that city, and they're afflicted. And then they got to move it to another. Finally, it goes to the city of Ekron. And by the time it got to the city of Ekron, the Philistine leaders were fed up with this thing. Yeah, okay, we got the Israelite sacred Ark of the Covenant. Yeah, but we got to get rid of this thing because we're having all these tumors, boils, hemorrhoids, if you like. And we got to get rid of this. So what do? They put a cart drawn by a team of oxen. They put the Ark of the Covenant on the cart. On the cart, they put golden mice and golden tumors. And the priests and the officials of the Philistines walk behind it up to Beth Shemesh in Israelite territory. Now, it's a cart, not a boat, because now we're on land, not on the ocean. But it's exactly the same protocol used in the Bronze Age by the Mycenaean Greeks, recorded much later in the 8th century by Homer. But isn't it amazing that a custom that was unique to the Philistines, by the way, who toasted the Philistines in the Bible? Who took out the Philistines so that they no longer existed? The Assyrians. In the late 8th century B.C., when the Assyrians came and took out the northern kingdom of Israel, they also wiped out the Philistines. So somebody writing a story about Philistines in the Bronze Age, if they're writing that story in the Iron Age, some Judahite priest trying to invent a history for Israel, how can he know this? How can he know the subtle ritual protocol of the Mycenaeans for giving back the Ark of the Covenant? But yet they nailed it. They got it exactly right. You can compare it to Homer, and it's there. So, that's really, really pretty incredible. Well, we could go on and talk about the history of the Iron Age Bible, but frankly, by the time you get to the Iron Age, there's so much material and so many kings and so many inscriptions and so many personal names of Bible people discovered in the archaeology of the Iron Age that no one in their right mind would doubt the historicity of Scripture once we get past the book of Judges. But it's that early Bronze Age Scripture that gets criticized. But when they criticize it, they fail to realize, they fail to pay attention. They fail to pay attention to the facts. And the archaeological facts are every single phrase, every single description of an object, of a cultural experience, of a cultural event in the Torah, in the book of Joshua and Judges, is all precisely as it should be from the Bronze Age. And so how can we trust that Bible? Absolutely. Absolutely. It is true. And I always tell people, the Bible is first and foremost a book of history. It's not first and foremost a book of spiritual truth or theology. First and foremost, it is a book of history. Now, the theology is woven in. The spiritual truth and insights are woven in and are often taught in the New Testament directly. But if you look at most of the Bible, it's history. It's history. Now, there's a lot to learn from history. There's a lot to apply to our lives from history. But the Bible is historical at its base, and it remains the finest, best geographical and historical collection of literature preserved from Near East antiquity, period. In that regard, it has no peer. Don't put the Bible on a shelf with the Book of Mormon or any other religious book. Don't put the Bible on the shelf with the inscriptions of Egypt or Mesopotamia or the Hittites or anybody else, because what they're writing is propaganda. Nobody in the Near East ever wrote history, cause and effect history, for the purpose of informing future generations about the past. Nobody. The only people that wrote history, the way history actually occurs, were the Israelites. And why does the modern world write history when historiography is done correctly? Why is it done the way it's done? Because we learned it from the Bible writers. That's how we learned to write history, because they did the history writing first, and we have copied their style. So nobody else in antiquity writes history. They write propaganda. But we have to sort through the propaganda in order to try to write a history of anything in antiquity. But the Bible gives it to us straight. And I'll repeat it. The Bible is still the best collection of geographical and historical source documents we have from antiquity in the Near East, period. It's the best. Nothing else even comes close. Well, that's all I have to say about that. Not. But we could talk all day. But kids, I hope you don't succumb to, and I'm talking about, when I say kids, it's like anybody between like 18 and 35, 40, right? Kids, don't let anyone knock you off your feet regarding trying to tell you that the Bible is not credible. Because unfortunately, across the best evangelical churches in the world, 80, 85% of the kids in evangelical churches around the world bail on the Christian faith by the time they reach age 25, losing our kids left and right. You know why? Because we're not teaching our kids the what. We're teaching them the what. We're not teaching them the why. What to believe. Here's what you believe. This is what you believe. But we've got to teach them why. We've got to teach them why. And when you get the why, and there are a lot of good books to do that, so get the why. Don't settle for the what. Always go for the why. So you understand. So you can listen to the opposition and hear what they say, analyze it, and have an answer. And that's what our conference here is all about. Giving an answer, apologetics, giving an answer for the hope that's within us. Giving a reason for what we believe. And there always are reasons. We have a faith based on fact, not a faith based on faith. It's a faith based on the bedrock of historical fact. All right, I'm going to leave it there, Pastor.
Once again, we've run out of time. Thank you for joining us here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number is 483-0586, or you may email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit the subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Just log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran.